This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 21, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Around the world, hundreds of thousands of people gathered to protest the invasion and ongoing occupation of Iraq. The Supreme Court declines to hear an appeal in the case of Zacharias Massawi. And, as crude oil prices reach an all-time high, we'll take a look at alternative fuel. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The streets of Kathmandu remain unusually quiet as taxis, trucks, rickshaws, and the thousands of motorcycles that usually fill the streets are virtually absent. About 24 student and youth leaders were arrested in the Kathmandu Valley after staging rallies last week demanding the restoration of democracy. Many of the leaders of the major political parties remain in jail or under house arrest. On February 1st, the King of Nepal issued a royal proclamation suspending all civil liberties in the Hindu kingdom. All rights of assembly, political protest, broadcast, publication by individuals, political parties, student, professional, or trade organizations have been met with brutal repression. Maoists vow to continue their people's war and control approximately 80% of the nation. They are also threatening to cut off supplies to the capital in April. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Louis Arbour, reporting on the situation in Nepal at the Convention of Human Rights in Geneva, said continued viability of the National Human Rights Institution had come under question. Michael Van Devere provided that report from Kathmandu, Nepal. California energy giant Unocal still denies responsibility for alleged human rights violations, but plaintiffs will be compensated in a settlement announced today. Lisa Wu has more from KPFA in Berkeley.
The settlement will compensate plaintiffs from Burma and provide funds enabling them and their representatives to develop programs to improve living conditions and protect the rights of the people from the pipeline region. In December, representatives from California-based Unocal said they had reached an agreement to resolve the cases filed by villagers in 1996. The Burmese claimed the company was responsible for atrocities committed by Myanmar's soldiers. The allegations included forced labor, murder, rape, torture, battery, and intimidation. Although the terms remain confidential, Center for Constitutional Rights senior attorney and counsel Jenny Green said the settlement is final and will be effective immediately. For Free Speech Radio News in Berkeley, California, I'm Lisa Wu.
Lawyers are threatening to take the British Attorney General to court because of his failure to prosecute soldiers involved in the death of an Iraqi in custody. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
26-year-old Baha Moussa died 3 days after he was arrested by soldiers of the Queen's Lancashire Regiment in Basra, Iraq, in 2003. One witness said that the prisoners were hooded, deprived of sleep, had freezing water poured over them, and became the victims of soldiers' games, including a version of kickboxing in which British troops would compete, quote, as to who could kickbox one of us the furthest. But 1.5 years later, despite severe criticism from High Court judges, the Army Prosecuting Authority has yet to recommend any action against any of the soldiers involved. In a landmark ruling last year, Britain's High Court said the Human Rights Act, which bans torture and inhuman or degrading treatment and guarantees the right to life, did extend specifically to the prison in Basra where Mr. Moussa died. The Ministry of Defence says the case is still with the Army Prosecuting Authority. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
In the wee hours of the morning, Congress passed and President Bush signed a measure to require a federal judge to review whether a feeding tube should be reinserted into Terri Schiavo. Critics of the measure say that Congress has overstepped its bounds by meddling in family matters and violating state rights, as well as the rights of Terri Schiavo, whose husband claims she would not want to live in a persistent vegetative state. But about 26 disability rights groups support keeping Schiavo alive, saying pulling her feeding tube perpetuates a standard of legal medical killing of people with severe disabilities. Mitch Jezerich reports from Washington.
A young woman in Florida is being dehydrated and starved to death. No more words, Mr. Speaker. She's waiting. Mr. Speaker, call the vote.
Somebody who's in favor say aye. With that, Congress took an unprecedented step in legislating on behalf of a single person by having a federal judge review whether a feeding tube should be reinserted into Terry Schiavo.
2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ entered Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, marking the beginning of a week that throughout history and the world over has signified the sanctity of human life.
For the Republicans, it was certainly a religious matter, Representative Jeff Miller of Florida.
And tonight we're here on Palm Sunday to afford the greatest presumption of life possible under our United States Constitution to a woman who has never truly been afforded representation and whose wishes are truly unknown.
The Senate passed the measure by unanimous consent. It also passed in the House, but a slight majority of Democrats voted against it, arguing the federal government has overstepped its jurisdiction. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida.
We are not doctors. We are not medical experts. We're not bioethicists. We are members of Congress. When I ran for Congress, I didn't ask my constituents for the right to insert myself in their private, personal, family decisions, and they don't want me to make those for them.
Democratic Representative Jim Moran of Virginia questions the Republican moral stand on the issue.
You know, on the same day that this legislation passed in the House, the Congress passed other legislation to take tens of billions of dollars out of the Medicaid program for indigent elderly people living in nursing homes. That affects whether they are going to live or die as well.
About 26 national disability rights groups support keeping Terry Schiavo alive. Stephen Drake, with the group called Not Dead Yet, says the Schiavo case is part of a larger euthanasia movement that he says targets people with the severest disabilities.
There's a horrible, horrible history in this country and all over the world about medical professionals and their feelings about people with disabilities, especially intellectual disabilities. It surfaced in the mid-1980s with the baby doe cases, where infants with disabilities were had fairly standard, simple medical treatment withheld from them. They were left basically in a corner of the nursery to die. So there's a long track record of the willingness of medical professionals to just write off some human lives. And we also know that some family members, some legal guardians who aren't and who aren't family, have a lower assessment of the quality or worth of a person's life than that individual would themselves.
And what about the husband's claim that she wouldn't want to live in this type of condition?
Even though a lot of people say they wouldn't want to live in a certain way once they acquire a severe disability, the fact is that most who once they get there do. Those who get intellectual disability or physical disability where they've lost all capacity for meaningful, you know, for purposeful movement, still want to go on with their lives. Is it fair with that to impose the assumption from an outside party that we're going to end their lives based on the fact that most people looking into the future say they wouldn't want to live that way, when most people who are actually living in that condition say, yeah, I do want to go on, or at least indicating it through their actions?
You're not pleased with how the Republicans have portrayed the issue either, are you?
Both the mainstream press and a lot of the players in the conservative right have tried to keep this, you know, as an aspect of their so-called culture wars. You know, this framing it in terms of the culture war is a way of basically, you know, just freezing people with disabilities out and letting us talk about this outside of a religious context.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Calling for the boldest changes since the implementation of the United Nations 60 years ago, Secretary General Kofi Annan urged world leaders today to adopt a reform package to overhaul the organization. Included in Annan's report are expanding the Security Council, reforming the Human Rights Commission, clearly defining terrorism, and setting new rules on when military force should be used. Joining us to talk about Annan's report is Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. You're the author of Calling the Shots, How the U.S. Dominates Today's UN. Will that domination change as a result of Annan's proposal?
No, I don't think so. In fact, the Secretary General's report reflects the kind of balancing act that he's had to do between standing in defense of the UN Charter and in defense of international law, as he is mandated to do, on the one hand, and on the other hand, giving in to the enormous U.S. pressure on the UN and the Secretary General that has massively increased in the last 2 years.
And Annan has stated that he thinks the invasion of Iraq was illegal. This weekend marked the 2-year anniversary of that invasion. Do you think we'll see any changes in Iraq as a result of this report?
Well, I don't think we're going to see changes in Iraq as a result of the report. I think it was important. It does reflect that view. The report says at one point that, quote, every nation that proclaims the rule of law at home must respect it abroad. That could easily be applied to the United States in Iraq. There's also a specific reference to the fact that only the Security Council and no individual government has the right to authorize the use of force in a preventive war against any threat that is not imminent. Now, of course, in the Iraq War, the U.S. claim was that there was, first they said an imminent threat, then they said, well, no, we didn't really mean imminent, but we meant a coming threat, a looming threat. And the position of this report is very clear that absent an actual attack or an imminent attack, meaning the guns are pointed and loaded and about to be fired, that only the Security Council has the right to authorize the use of force in what would be called a preventive war. So there is a reiteration, if you will, of the view that the Iraq War was illegal, even though the words are not stated exactly in that form. He also sets out an internationalist view that, among other things, says that the International Criminal Court remains the centerpiece for international justice. This flies in the face of the Bush administration's longstanding opposition to the International Criminal Court, particularly significant given the appointment of John Bolton as the new United Nations ambassador for the U.S. Bolton has staked out a very harsh rejection of the International Criminal Court, claiming that the day that President Bush supposedly unsigned, a concept unknown in international law, we should note, but that the day that the International Criminal Court treaty was, quote, unsigned, was what John Bolton called the happiest day of his public service life. So in that context, a number of these other issues are quite important.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joined us today from Washington. The Supreme Court today declined to hear an appeal in the case of Zacharias Massawi, letting stand a lower court's decision to deny Massawi's attorney access to potential witnesses in U.S. detention. Massawi is the first person accused of involvement in the September 11, 2001 hijackings being tried in U.S. courts. From our D.C. Bureau, Darby Hickey reports.
By upholding the federal appellate court's ruling against Zacharias Massawi, the Supreme Court allows prosecutors to push for the death penalty, while denying Massawi access to suspected al-Qaeda operatives captured overseas who could serve as witnesses in the case. Several of the potential witnesses, such as alleged al-Qaeda mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, are actually named in the case against Massawi, but he and his attorneys will only have access to the summaries of their U.S. interrogators. Arsalan Iftikhar, legal director at the Council on American-Islamic Relations, describes the legal issues at play in the case.
There are three major constitutional legal issues that were in play, the Fifth, the Sixth, and the Eighth Amendments, most notably the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees the right of a defendant to call available witnesses to testify. In this case, he would not have that defense. He would need to rely on government summarized affidavits of the witnesses. Obviously, the Fifth Amendment right of due process and the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment dealing with the death penalty were also issues that were brought up by Massawi's lawyers.
Charged with helping the men who hijacked planes on September 11th, Zacharias Massawi is a French national who was arrested by the FBI in the summer of 2001. The Supreme Court would have been more likely to take up the case and decide it in his favor, say legal experts like Iftikhar, if he were a U.S. citizen. Constitutional rights are viewed as giving less protection to non-U.S. citizens, they say. And although any actions by the Supreme Court sets a precedent, two other recent decisions by the court are likely to have a stronger impact, Iftikhar says.
I think that this will have a little bit of an effect, legally speaking, but I also think that the Hamdi and Padilla rulings were probably more legally strong in determining the scope and the limit to which the government can marginalize the constitutional liberties of individuals.
The cases of Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla centered around the question of whether the government could designate a U.S. citizen as an enemy combatant, thereby stripping them of certain constitutional rights. the court has ruled that they and other detainees are able to appeal their treatment in U.S. courts. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Rallies against the invasion and ongoing occupation of Iraq were staged around the world, marking a global day of action. About 20,000 people demonstrated in Istanbul. FSRN's Ozan Under has more.
Last weekend, in the 19th of March, it was the second anniversary of the war in Iraq. Ayaz Ahmed, the Indian Marxist intellectual that we spoke last week, claims that the anti-war movement is everywhere around the world.
Middle classes, who are already opposed to the war, as they have shown in a number of polls in the United States, and who simply are not going to go and fight the war. So the social basis of the war inside the United States are very limited.
A worker who was joined to the manifestation by the Cellulose and Paper Workers Union, who were in strike in last 50 days to resist against the privatization of their factory SECA, claims that
we are here because of being against imperialism, against the policies on Iraq, all of society. We have to show the entire world that what's going on is so primitive, so ancient. We are here to stop the war of the dangerous policies of Bush and global capitalism.
The meeting is organized by the Global Peace and Justice Coalition and the Labor Platform. There were about 20,000 manifesting people just in Istanbul. Besides individual activists, cortes of organizations such as trade unions, political parties and NGOs were on the streets.
The dominant idea says that capitalism is the only possible kind of relationship. But we know that another world is possible, and we are for the establishment of that world. The anti-war movement stopped the Turkish troops from joining the imperialist war in Iraq on the 1st of March 2003. In order not to lose this political effect, we've got to organize ourselves in an anti-militarist, anti-imperialist, and anti-capitalist political frame.
Global Day of Action, the people of the planet was up for a fundamental demand. Stop the war immediately, right now. This is Ozan Önder for Free Speech Radio News, Istanbul.
Protesters this weekend often came up against confrontations with police. 2,000 to 3,000 people rallied on the Boston Common on Sunday afternoon. Afterwards, several hundred marched through downtown Boston in an unpermitted protest that ended with 5 arrests. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Boston-based historian and combat veteran Howard Zinn emphasized the role of the military in ending the war in Vietnam.
Young guys were refusing to show up for the draft and going to Canada, and soldiers were refusing to go out on the line, and airmen were refusing to fly more missions, and the ROTC chapters were closing up. And when that was happening, and when that started to happen, the government could not continue the war. And that's going to happen. That's going to happen here. A point will be reached. So if we persist, if we continue, if we don't give up.
At the end of the rally, Boston City Council member Chuck Turner led an unpermitted march past the Armed Forces recruiting office. Gertie Lahens is a Haitian immigrant who joined the march.
I want to see people unified. That's the only way we can fight what's going on. This is the only way we can fight. This is imperialism, because there was no need for war. It's our children, our immigrants, our poor children that they're standing there to die for no reason.
Just as marchers crossed back onto Boston Common, scuffles broke out and 5 people were arrested. 3, including a 15-year-old, faced several serious felony charges. The National Lawyers Guild's Ursula Masnilatos said today,
those of us who were there didn't see any provocation, any action coming from anti-war protesters that would lead to chaos and violence that we witnessed at the end of the rally.
Efforts to get a statement from police were unsuccessful. In Boston, for FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
Some 10,000 protesters marched through Hollywood this weekend, joining worldwide demonstrations to commemorate the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq and demand an end to war. From KPFK in Los Angeles, FSRN's Paige Goetz files this sound collage.
And this day, March 19th, the bombing of Baghdad, and have killed since 100,000 innocent people who had absolutely nothing to do with whatever this country is going on about called September 11th.
I am Cheryl Johnson with the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Their community has been desecrated. They're in more chaos now than they were before the Americans arrived.
They don't answer questions about, you know, we're building 14 permanent bases in Iraq. They don't answer anything about why we're doing that if the people haven't even voted as to whether we should stay or go.
We've been having more and more hospitals that are losing services and are being threatened with closure and with privatization, all because the Bush administration wishes to take those resources and throw them into the war machine that is currently going on in Iraq.
Why in the world would anyone want us there? When the lights don't work any longer, when their schools don't open anymore, when the water is not fit to drink.
If Muhammad Ali was still out there, he'd say, you know, no Iraqi person ever did anything to me. So whatever way they defend themselves is all right with me.
According to the Department of Defense, nearly 15,000 U.S. troops have been wounded in Iraq. Engaged in a war with no front lines and heavy use of explosives, young soldiers who enter battle in prime physical condition leave with severe injuries. Upon return to the U.S., soldiers often face precarious medical treatment. Two American doctors who have treated patients in Afghanistan, Germany, Kuwait, and near the combat zone in Iraq have now returned home to their base in Denver, Colorado. Maria Collier has more.
Dr. Jean Bowles, a neurosurgeon at Denver Health, was chief of neurosurgery at Landstuhl Medical Center in Germany beginning in November 2001. He was the only neurosurgeon covering an area that extended from the Middle East to Europe. When he started working at Landstuhl, Dr. Bowles was treating 30 to 60 patients a day. Out of those numbers, he treated 5 to 10 patients per day who needed neurosurgery.
The numbers of serious combat casualties increased very significantly and on an ongoing basis after we started fighting in Iraq, which would have been in March. The injuries were very, very horrific, involving primarily young people. Many people lost their arms and legs. There were serious burns as well as serious brain and spine injuries and a lot of blindness.
Colonel Alan Brewer, a member of the Army Reserve and an anesthesiologist at the University of Colorado Hospital, was commander of a medical support unit in Afghanistan and Kuwait. He ran the operating rooms at Kuwait Armed Forces Hospital, which is the only fixed hospital building in Kuwait.
I worked at the only trauma center available. There were lots of burns and bombings. Even though our soldiers are wearing body armor, the use of explosives is causing major injuries. I trained in a major trauma center, so I was used to carnage, but the numbers were overwhelming. The burns were bad. The victims were run over by tanks. There were lots of amputations of both soldiers and civilians. Over a period of 6 months, we treated from 300 to 400 patients altogether.
Both Bowles and Brewer wonder what lies ahead for the soldiers coming home to medical care under the Veterans Administration, which had already cut back on services before the Iraq War began.
Prior to 9/11, we were downsizing our military and our hospitals. Several had been closed, and funding for them had been cut over the previous years. Now we have a very significant increase in the need for them, but they are very inefficient in the way they offer their services. It's taking way too long for many of our soldiers to get appointments, reports of up to a year at times, and an average of 3 to 6 months.
In Denver, Colorado, I'm Maria Collier for Free Speech Radio News.
As the U.S. Congress took a step forward to open up oil exploration in Alaska's National Wildlife Refuge last week, crude oil prices reached an all-time high of $57 per barrel on the world market. The ripple effect can be seen at gas stations throughout the U.S. FSRN's Vinny Lombardo looks at the causes and examines some alternatives to an oil-driven society.
The reason oil is so expensive right now on the international market is that supply is having trouble meeting demand. It's that simple.
Richard Heinberg, who teaches sustainable ecology at New College of California, has been tracking oil depletion for about 7 years. The author of two books on the topic, Heinberg contends global oil production has reached its maximum output of about 84 million barrels a day.
We're hitting up against the natural limits of Earth's productive capacity to meet our ever-increasing demands for more petroleum. So I would expect probably more price volatility this year. I wouldn't expect prices to go down.
A recent study commissioned by the U.S. Department of Energy backs up that position. The report, titled "The Peaking of World Oil Production," concludes oil depletion is unlike any problem yet faced by modern industrial society. The challenges and uncertainties need to be much better understood, the study found, but technologies exist to mitigate the problem. This past Saturday, some of those technologies were on display in Felton, California, at an alternative fuels fair.
This is a diesel engine. It's a six-cylinder diesel engine. It runs on 100% biodiesel.
Henry Carter has been working on cars since he was 14 years old. For over a decade, Henry and wife Lisa Carter have run Waterstar Motors, an import auto repair shop in Santa Cruz. The family-run business is one of the few places in the region who sell biodiesel, a fuel made from vegetable oil and mixed with ethanol, to create what Lisa Carter refers to as a sustainable fuel.
We can grow it on American soil, and the farmers can be really happy because they'll get paid for all their crops. It can be made from many plants. The most popular, of course, is soybeans, as well as grapeseed oil. You can take it from the fryer grease from the restaurants.
At present, biodiesel retails for $3.60 per gallon, and less than 1% of the total diesel fuel consumption in the U.S. is biodiesel. But according to Brent Loucher, vice president of Pacific Biofuels, Inc., that number is rapidly growing.
You have to dig a little bit for it, but it's moving so fast that it's actually becoming more readily available than I think a lot of people know. Biodiesel is now being used in every state in the union and being processed in every state in the union.
Many local and state governments are turning to biodiesel for emergency vehicles and public transit. 2 years ago, Berkeley, California was first to use 100% biodiesel in all city vehicles, but recently halted the program after two city trucks had engine failure due to mold in the fuel. Any car with a diesel engine can run on biofuel, but for vegetable oil, you'll need some adjustments. Steve Schiff, a farmer from Corralitos, California, converted his Ford F-150 pickup to run on used fryer grease he gets from a falafel shop.
It entailed putting copper wiring in the bottom of the tank and then running a hose within a hose, they call it, which runs coolant from your engine through the tank to keep the vegetable oil heated.
If that's too much trouble, those seeking to reduce their dependence on fossil fuel have other options.
Any fuel-injected car can use somewhere between 30 to 50% alcohol with no changes whatsoever because modern cars have enough flexibility and feedback built into the computer system.
In 1983, Dave Bloom, president of the Institute for Ecological Agriculture, produced a 10-part television series, Alcohol as Fuel, for KQED. The station pulled the series after Chevron threatened to cut off funding. Alcohol fuel made from corn or sugar beets is a lot like moonshine, Bloom says, and much cleaner burning than gasoline.
Basically, it's now possible to grow our way into energy self-sufficiency.
In the Midwest, there's nearly 600 stations that sell alcohol at the pump. Bloom says Santa Cruz County's first cooperatively run alternative fueling station will open up in the near future. Reporting in Santa Cruz, I'm Vinny Lombardo for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.